story. But I do know that Keith is patriotic because he's got a little American flag here on his lapel. And he looks like he's got a very pleasant face. And he looks like he's... have you ever seen one without a pleasant face? Oh, well. But anyway, I know he's anxious to get up here and tell his story, and I know that we're... We're anxious to hear it. So, Keith.
Thank you, Jane. My name is Keith Lewis. I'm an alcoholic. I'm profoundly grateful to be here this morning. The theme seems to be humility. So that's enough about me. What do you think of my tie? I really am grateful to be here, and I want to thank Don and the committee for inviting me. I want to thank my friend Dick and Barbara A. for keeping me up on everything and give me a blow-by-blow as this has developed. And I want to thank the folks from Athens. You Athenians have a beautiful town. I'm from Wilmington, North Carolina. That's where I live now, and I'm a member of the Midtown group. And I would have been here Thursday night to hear the talk, but Midtown celebrated our 14th anniversary, and so I wanted to be there for that. It was great to see your wonderful delegate, John, and our delegate spoke for us Thursday night, and Donna B. did a wonderful job. I really appreciate the folks who dedicate themselves to service in Alcoholics Anonymous. There's so much that goes on behind the scenes in Alcoholics Anonymous that most of us don't see. And there's a lot of hard work that goes on, and I am profoundly grateful that, you know, I came to Alcoholics Anonymous on May the 13th, 1973, and it had been well preserved from 1935 until 1973, and that's what we owe the next generation. You know, people say to me, do you get nervous when you talk? And the answer is that people who ask me get nervous when I talk. I don't get nervous because either way, I get in a car and go home. Either way. But I'm particularly not nervous this time because, you know, I couldn't add or detract from this weekend. It's just been absolutely magnificent from Kelly and the marvelous job she did and my friend Dennis, with whom I've spoken many times, my fellow North Carolinian. I wasn't born in North Carolina, but I'm a naturalized citizen. My wife was born there, and I'm working on the language. I have a long way to go, I know, but it was just wonderful. And then to see my friend Don, whom I hadn't seen for many, it must be 15 years since we spoke together. And the one thing I'm sure is that we're both better looking and happier than we were 15 years ago. And I think we look younger, too. It's just a thought. I don't know. But So, you know, I've been given so much already that it would be virtually impossible for me to... Maybe I'll be an after-dinner man or something like that. But it has just been marvelous. And to see so many of my friends in Georgia... This is about my eighth time to speak in Georgia this year. And so for those of you who have been here seven times before, I apologize. You know, I was born in a small town in Ohio, a place called Martins Ferry. If you hadn't been there, I wouldn't bother. And I'm the eldest son, the second child in a family of 11 children. I'm Irish. I won't tell you what church we went to. Had something to do with bingo, I can tell you that. And I would have told you that we were poor. And I would have been wrong about that, too. I've been wrong about everything. I've been thinking a lot this last year about what I had and what I grew up with and the tremendous blessings that I had. And, you know, Don mentioned it and Scott and everybody mentioned the gratitude for what they were given as young people. You know, even if it looked bad at the time, everything that I have as a result of those two parents. Who loved me, just loved me. And my problem was is I had this condition, okay? It's become an issue over the last 15 years, but it used to be a condition. And it's called selfishness and self-centeredness, and it's all about me. And And part of this condition is isolation. Even as a little kid, I was totally isolated. I was surrounded by people who loved me, and I couldn't experience it. My old friend Bob B. always talked about alcoholism being a disease that didn't allow me to recognize that I was being loved the way I was supposed to be loved. And I was never loved the way I thought I needed to be loved. Bob got sober on the streets of Atlanta in the Biscayne Room. And Bob was absolutely convinced that he was far more isolated before he went to Skid Row than he was after he got to Skid Row. He said once he got to Skid Row, it just didn't matter anymore. And that's been my story. I don't think being drunk is a major symptom of what it is I have. I think being isolated and being selfish and being self-centered is a major symptom of what I had. I was a kid who had something lived under his bed, and I knew what it was there for. It was waiting for me to dangle my little legs over the side of the bed, and I was history, and I knew that. And I also knew I couldn't talk to anybody about it. I was a kid who was convinced that somebody else had what belonged to me. And I just knew if I got a little bit more. I lived in a world that was filled with shortages. There wasn't quite enough love. There wasn't quite enough material goods. There wasn't quite enough affirmation or recognition or any of the rest of it. It was never enough. And so I always came up short. You know, I began to generate resentments when I was a tiny little kid. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous absolutely convinced that what was wrong with me was that I grew up in poverty. And some, you know, old-timers are pushy in a way. So an old-timer said to me, "Don't you have a brother who's an officer with American Telephone and Telegraph Company?" I said, "Yes, I do." And he said, "Where'd he grow up?" And I said, "Well, we had slept in the same bed. There were three of us in that bed." And he said, "Well, I know what your problem is. You slept on the wrong side of the bed. That's what your problem is." But I was absolutely convinced that I had been victimized from my very first breath. And that's classically selfishness and self-centeredness. You know, I was a kid who desperately wanted to belong. Had a horrible speech impediment, just a terrible speech impediment. And everybody around me treated me like I was normal. And I wanted to be treated not normal, but special. They didn't seem to understand it. Remember, I went off to grade school. And my mother was always so proud of me. She always told me, "I'm so proud of you, son. You're such a special young man. I'm so proud of you." And I didn't know what I wanted her to say. I wanted her to say something different. Because saying that didn't make me feel any different. And she told me I could sing real good. So when they asked if somebody wanted to sing, I volunteered. And my mother was standing with the other parents in the front of the classroom, and she sort of drifted to the back of the crowd. And I put my hand up, and I stood up, and I belted out that old-time favorite, "I'm a gand old fag, I'm a high-flying fag." And my mother was so proud she cried. It was just amazing. But I tell you, the real problem, if it wasn't poverty, the real problem was the fact that my father never told me he loved me. Dad never told me he loved me. And that's really what I wanted to hear. I wanted Dad to say, "I love you." And Dad never said it. And that's why in May of 1973, I was living in the basement of a house in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., drinking myself to death. Would have been so easy. He could have said it. Everything would have been all right. Of course, he said it a million times. I just never heard it. He never said it the way I needed him to say it. And, you know, it's an amazing thing. I've discovered in the almost 30 years that I've been privileged to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I've discovered it. My real problem is that I never got it right with Dad. I never got it right with Dad. And if you don't get it right with Dad, I'm convinced, particularly if you're a man, you don't get it right with anybody. And I went through life being owed things. I went through life with a list of things that I had coming. We call that selfishness and self-centeredness. And I always had it. I was a kid who tried very, very hard, very hard to be good. And I wasn't very good at being good because I was owed so much. I kept clicking back to what I was owed and where's mine and has anybody seen mine and who's got mine. So I decided I was going to be bad. And I wasn't very good at being bad either. I formed a gang in high school. I couldn't think of a name, and we were in history class, and somebody mentioned the great composer Wolfgang Mozart. And so I said we'll be Mozart's Wolfgang. And and I was elected president. I was Mozart. And we didn't have enough money to buy black leather jackets, so we bought black nylon jackets. We really weren't very good at this. And we pulled our first job one morning. We got together and stole a watermelon from the old man who owned a confectionery store near the high school. And during the course of that day, all six of us snuck back and paid the man for the watermelon. We just weren't good at this stuff. And then the next morning, he got us all together and said, you know, all you boys paid me for that watermelon, and we were all embarrassed. And he said, give it up, kids. You know, he said, your parents are too nice. You're never going to make it. And horrible. And so I got into a lot of trouble. I was a kid who I suspended 28 times in high school. And I was an honor student with 23 Fs and 1 D in conduct. 4 years. The principal, Father Wilmowski, pulled me aside and said, I'm not going to give you an F in conduct the last marking period because nobody gets out of here with a perfect record. So I spent a lot of time doing detention in high school. I don't know what they do now, but we used to have to serve detention in high school. What you had to do in my high school was you had to make rosary beads. I went to a Catholic high school and you had to spend time with Sister Victoria and Sister Victoria was an odd little duck. She used to say things like, every boy's a prince and every girl's a princess because we have a father who's a king, and, you know, strange stuff like that. And she told me that I was a prince, but I had to be, you know, I was contagious, so she would isolate me behind a magazine rack when I served my detention in a library, and I'd make rosary beads. They'd give you wire and pliers and beads and things, and I'd make these rosary beads. And what they did was they took the rosary beads that the bad kids made, and they sent them to the missions all around the world. And my rosary beads were different than your average rosary bead. Most of them had 10 beads in every decade, and I made them with 11 beads in every decade. So, you know, at the end of 4 years, there were hundreds of mutant rosary beads all over the world. And you know, she never caught on. You know, spiritual people aren't very smart, I discovered. And she just never caught on. So you can't leave without them knowing. You know, if they don't know, it's like, you know, you wasted 4 years. So I went up to her and I said, Sister, you know what I've been doing the last 4 years? She said, yes, I do, you sly little prince. She said, you've been putting extra beads in all the rosaries, and I know why. And I remember thinking, I hope she tells me, because I have the foggiest notion of why I do this thing. She said, all over the world, people are praying extra prayers, and God's going to give you all the credit. Don't you just hate people like that? And then she told me something that absolutely terrified me. She told me that one day, she said, you're a very special child of God. And she said, one day, you're going to go around the world and tell God's children just how very much he loves them. And I was this kid with this horrible speech impediment, and I was terrified of life, and I was angry with life. And at age 17, I was already overwhelmed with life, and God's going to give me a mission going around the world and telling people how very much he loves them. So in honor of Sister Victoria, if you don't know, God does love you. I was at Mass this morning, and I was in the back of the church, and I was just looking, and I was just overwhelmed with the knowledge that God loves us so. You know, I have this horrible habit of being grateful for things that just make you crazy. I mean, you know, when you're owed a lot and you're grateful, it screws up your whole day. And I was thinking about what a magnificent country we live in, and it just a thought that came to me this morning. You know, I was at 9/11. I had gotten out of Newark, New Jersey airport 2 days before that happened, and the following Friday I was in the American Airlines Training Center in Dallas-Fort Worth Airport at one of our functions, and I got the first plane out of Wilmington and then the first plane out of Atlanta, and I was thinking that weekend that, you know, this may be the only country in the history of the world that Alcoholics Anonymous could have happened in. We know that Alcoholics Anonymous is a spiritual program, and we know that it works anywhere. But where it happened was here, and I think it happened here because of who and what we are. You know, you can be an American and you can be anything else. And I think it had to happen here. I'm grateful for the parents that I had. You know, I had a father who every day I let him would spend time with me. I had a father who never owned an automobile until the last kid went to college. I had a father who never took a vacation. He worked every vacation to buy bicycles and shoes for his little children. I had a mother who had a heart bigger than outdoors. Incredible woman, never finished high school till all of us had. And then she went to high school, and then she took her college entrance boards, and she outscored all of us. But she didn't think it was a big deal. She said, after all, I have been through high school 12 times, you know. And I was so profoundly grateful to that woman. I remember every night, she would... We had a lot of kids who stayed with us who didn't have any place else to go. You know, once you get over a certain number, it doesn't matter anymore. And we had this routine. Every night, all the girls would go through the bathroom upstairs, and then all the boys would go through the shower downstairs, and we'd all get ready for bed. And we'd go through, we'd stand in line and take our shower and throw the dirty things in the dirty clothes and put on our pajamas and go upstairs. And we'd all get in assigned beds, and like kindlingwood, we'd be stacked. And my mother would come to each bedroom and read us a story or a poem. And I remember... her favorite poem was A Vision of Sir Longfellow. And I don't know if anybody remembers it. Lowell wrote it. And what it was a man who set out on a quest, much like I think many of us set out on quests. And he was pretty full of himself, much like I was pretty full of myself. And he went out, and he's going to find the Holy Grail, the cup of Christ. And he was out for 20 years, and life wasn't good to him. He discovered he was powerless over life, and his life had become unmanageable. And he came back to Camelot, a beaten man. On the way out, he went by a beggar who was a leper. And he asked him if he could help him, and he tossed him a gold coin. Because this guy's a pretty big-hearted guy, you know, and he's a high roller. 20 years later, as a beaten, broken man, he came back. He said, the beggar was there, was a leper. And he said, can you help me? And he got down off his horse, and he took his bowl, and he filled it with water and fed water to the leper. And that was the Grail. And my mother used to say these words to us, and we had to memorize them. She would end and with tears in her eyes, and she would always say, you know, it's not what we give, but what we share. The gift without the giver is bare. And, you know, I'm so grateful that I had a mother who told me that. She didn't teach me that. I had to learn that the hard way. But she told me that. And I'm just so profoundly grateful for that. I'm grateful I have the brothers and sisters I have. I'm grateful that I was taught about God, and I was taught about right, and I was taught about wrong. I remember when I was new in Alcoholics Anonymous, my mother looked at me with tears in her eyes, and she asked a question. Where did I go wrong? Where did I go wrong? And I said to her, Mom, you got me here. You know, when I grew up, I was privileged. And my friend Mike W. says it beautifully. He said there was a line that was right about here. And what was above the line was right. And what was below the line was wrong. He said now there's a vast gray area. And everybody decides for themselves what's right and wrong. Somebody asked me why. You know, my sponsor, Tom I, calls me up. He gives me things to do to keep me out of trouble. And he called me about 15 years ago. He said, Keith, he said, you know, it used to be that 3 out of 4 people who walked into Alcoholics Anonymous got sober. He said, now I don't think 1 in 10 does. Why is that? I said, I'll get right on it, Tom. And I thought about it. And, you know, the next day he called me or I called him in his office. And I didn't say anything. I said, convulsions. He said, excuse me? I said, this is Keith. The answer is convulsions. I said, when's the last time you saw a convulsion in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous? He said, you know, it's been a long time. You know, when I was new, I got sober in Washington, D.C. I went to meetings in the center of the city, and once a week, I'd be sitting there saying, you know, you're too young to be with these old fools. And somebody would have a convulsion. And I'd say, well, maybe I'll stick around just a few more days. But I think the real reason I'm here is because there was a definitive set of principles upon which you lived a successful life. I was either, what I did was either right or it was wrong. And alcoholism for me is a process of doing more and more and more of what was wrong and trying to find a way to live with it. Trying to come up with a reason that what's wrong for you is right for me in this particular situation. And that was a great gift that my parents gave me. There was a definite right and there was a definite wrong. You know, I really believe that the life we lead, that I'm privileged to lead today, is a life where the road narrows. Now, you know, when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, I loved that second step because the second step said that the way I was acting made sense. I was supposed to be halfway around the bend. In the second step, I could move back and forth. There was plenty of room. They say, believe whatever you want to. Believe whatever you want to. Don't drink. Come to meetings. And I'm thinking, I could get along in an organization like this. But then, you know what happened? The steps are like an inverted triangle. And the longer I'm sober, and the more I work the steps, you know, eventually it gets down to a pretty narrow spot, and it says, God's will. I said, wait a minute, how about anything I want to do? No, no, no. It's too late for that. You know? Now, what I find amazing about that is that the triangle is inverse to freedom. And the more I'm willing to be disciplined, you know, the more I'm willing to live my life based upon a set of principles, not the principles I come up with and what I can live with, but basic sets of human principles that were given to us over a long period of time. The better I can live that, the freer I am. You know, I was a man who was never faithful in any relationship. I don't just mean interpersonal relationship. I mean any relationship. As a member of the Marine Corps, I sat around thinking about joining the Air Force. There's a step down. No, I'm just kidding. But I could never faithful. I had a job I liked, and I'd go through the one ads every morning when I was drinking my coffee. You know, I would finally find a woman who was willing to date me, and I'd immediately start looking for the next one. I was absolutely incapable of being honest or faithful to a relationship. Absolutely incapable of doing it. And consequently, I lived in a constant state of anxiety. I'm a married man. I'm married 13 years now to probably the most wonderful woman in the world. This moment, Julia's praying. She prays the hour I talk. We have a prayer room in our house. Her theory is that God gave us a house, we'll give him a room. And that's where we hear fifth steps and do all that stuff. And this moment, she's sitting in that room praying because that's what she does. I don't know how that happened to me. But I'm convinced of one thing, and that is that Alcoholics Anonymous really is about building character. It is. It's not about being happy. It's about building character. True freedom is building character and then living based upon a set of principles that minimize me and maximize you. You know, I had my first real drink. Well, I had my first drink when I was 5 years old. I ought to tell you about that because it's you really ought to drink if you're going to be a member of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I had my first drink when I was 5 years old. And I was at home. I didn't go out a lot when I was five. I was with my father and my brother, Dumb Denny. Denny was four. And Mom was out. She was either at the bingo or having a baby or doing something. And Dad was watching us, and I think he thought it would be sort of funny, and he gave us each a beer. And there was really alcohol around our house, but he gave us each a beer. And nothing happened to me, nothing. I drank it, nothing happened. Denny, on the other hand, was having a spiritual awakening. He was rolling around under the table singing Mary Had a Little Lamb and other drinking songs. And my dad kind of panicked, and he wrestled him to the ground. And he put his, you know, took his clothes off and put his little jammies on. And he said to me, he said, go to bed, son. Don't tell your mother about this, and I'll take you to the movies this weekend. And I thought, you know, when you're five, they don't negotiate a lot with you. So I was game, but Denny wasn't hearing it. He was singing and carrying on, having the time of his life. And I never forget, little Denny stood up in his crib and he urinated on the floor. And I remember thinking, you know, there's a kid who's powerless over alcohol and whose life has become unmanageable. And you know, Denny never seemed to make it. It's the strangest thing. He, you know, with a start like that, you'd expect something out of somebody. But you know, he grew up and did strange things. You know, Denny went to one school. Yeah, one college. Went to the University of Ohio in Athens, Ohio. He had one major. It gets worse. He graduated in 4 years. I never heard of such a thing. He went to one graduate school. He graduated first in his class. He offered like 8 jobs. He took one. You know? And he retired about 8 years ago, I guess. He was a vice president in a large international corporation. Strangest thing of all is he married one woman. Now, here's a guy who had the world in the palm of his hands when he was 4 years old, and he just let it slip through his fingers. Now, I had to work at this thing. I was 21 years old before I urinated on the bedroom floor for the first time. So the second time I drank was, I graduated from high school, much to everyone's surprise, and it was clear to me that I wasn't going to college. I mean, you know, we had no excess material goods, and my sister Patty was in college, and my brother Denny had a rheumatic fever, and he had a bad heart and things, and so it was very clear he'd have to go to college. So I knew that I had to leave town because I didn't know what I was going to do. So I knew if you leave town, they'll think you're doing what it is you're going to do. And back then, everybody went in the military. It wasn't if, it was where and when. If you were a male, you went in the military. So I took my first inventory. I, you know, stood in front of the mirror and I flexed my muscles and turned sideways and stuck my chest out. I was 5'1" tall and I weighed 113 pounds. And whatever else I was a born killer. So I went over to Wheeling, West Virginia and joined the Marine Corps. And I forgot to share it with my parents, and they seemed to be interested. It was amazing to me, but it tore them out of their frame. My poor mother, God rest her soul, she was just beside herself, and the recruiter showed up because they had to sign. I wasn't yet 18 years of age, and my dad said, "Are you sure you want to do this, son?" I said, "Dad, I've been thinking about this a long time. I thought about it for an hour and a half." And he said, "Well, all right." And they signed it. And my mother cried all night, the poor thing. I'll never forget. And she kept saying, "Scott, they'll kill him." And my dad kept saying, "Don't worry, Pat, they won't take him." So with that vote of confidence, the next morning, we got a taxi cab and went over to Wheeling, West Virginia. And I got on a Greyhound bus and I went to Pittsburgh. It was 60 miles away. It was the second longest trip I'd ever been on in my life. And this terrified little kid who knew absolutely nothing about anything was sworn in the Marine Corps that afternoon. It was a bad year, and they took you if you had a pulse. And that evening, with three men from Pittsburgh who joined, I went to a local bar, and that's where it happened for me. That's where booze did for me what nothing else had ever done. It was somewhere between the second and third drink that my life changed, and it changed so dramatically and so profoundly that day in 1961 dictated the terms of the rest of my life. And only an alcoholic can understand that. I guess an Al-Anon can when she meets him or her. But that day, it happened for me. It was absolutely magnificent. For the first time in my life, I saw the big picture. And I'll never forget that night as long as I live. Because I spent the next 12 years trying to get back to Pittsburgh. Just trying to get back to that moment when I belonged. And I was truly the center of the universe, the way I knew it always should have been. And life made sense to me, and it no longer overwhelmed me, and I didn't have one ounce of anxiety. You know, I didn't care about it. I knew all about the Marine Corps all of a sudden. You know, I never knew anything about the Marine Corps, and I didn't know you could ask. I knew they took a certain number of men to South Carolina and drowned them in a swamp every year, but I didn't know anything else. And so I was launched that night. It was July the 13th, 1961. I was launched into alcoholism. And somebody said to me one time, "What do you think alcoholism is?" And I said, "Alcoholism is a disease where alcohol works. That's what alcoholism is. It doesn't make you feel a little better. That's what it does to normal people. You know, it doesn't relieve some of the anxieties. Alcohol totally transformed a frightened, terrified 17-year-old kid into whatever he wanted to be." And, you know, that night I remember walking around the bar from table to table explaining life to all these people. It was incredible. And we left and got on a train. I think we got on a train because I woke up on a train. And And I was on a Pullman coach the Marine Corps had kindly provided for me. And I was lying on the floor of the Pullman coach, and someone had wet the floor I was lying on. And whoever it was, they had wet me too. And I was 300 miles from home, and that's three times as far as I'd ever been. And I was in Washington, D.C. And I changed my clothes, and I got off the train, and the guys were waiting for me. And they said, "What took you so long?" And I opted out. And I said, "I'm going to go find something to drink." And that's what I did. So the second day of my drinking, I drank in the morning. And I drank on that train till we got to South Carolina. And then when we got to South Carolina that night, I fell off the train across the next set of railroad tracks. And there was a very rude man there they'd sent to greet us. He was hurling obscenities at myself and the other young men who went down there to die for their country. And I got up and I brushed myself off and I tried to explain to this cretin that he'd get along with us a lot better if he treated us with some respect. And he never seemed to grasp what it was I was trying to get across to him. And I think he was just screaming too loud. They say you can learn from every situation. What I learned from that situation is you can do a lot of push-ups drunk. That's what I learned from that. In case you're wondering, you can do push-ups and throw up at the same time. And the next morning, they took me to Paris Island, and I entered the Marine Corps. And I must say, it was one of the great days of my life. I loved it from the first day on. It just made sense to me. And I've thought about it a lot. I mean, no one who's in their right mind loves the Marine Corps the first day on Paris Island. I mean, you got all these idiots who practice screaming at you. And they're good at it. And they get right in your face, and they spit on you when they're just, I just loved every bit of it. I was a pretty athletic little kid, so I never had any trouble with that part of it. And I've discovered that I used to think that, if you hadn't noticed, I'm short. I know, I used to be tall and I've been sick. But I used to think that being short was a problem. You know, it's really not, check a guy like Dennis. You know, his knees are going to go a lot sooner than mine. And plus, they would expect Dennis to do 100 push-ups. They wouldn't expect me to do 100 push-ups. I could do 300 push-ups, and I always acted like 50 were a lot. And they'd say, "Give me 10 more," and I'd crank out 10 more, and I'd strain and groan and all the rest of it. And I had another 50 back there I could use. So I was, it was easy for me. And I got out of Paris Island, and I won Dress Blues Award and Outstanding Man's Award and all that business. And every promotion I ever got in the Marine Corps was a meritorious promotion. I came in first, second, and third in all the classes. And the reason wasn't because I was particularly bright. The reason was I loved it. I just loved everything about it. I volunteered to do everything I could do. I went to mountain climbing school. I did all kinds of things, I was a free man because I had alcohol. You know, I discovered that alcoholics are pretty enthusiastic people. All you had to do is be around here this weekend, and if you didn't gather that, you weren't listening. But alcoholics are enthusiastic people. And I think what alcoholism is for me is that, I fall madly in love with a way of life. It's just the way it is. And then gradually or not so gradually, I begin to violate every principle associated with that way of life. And then I leave that way of life, and I blame them for what happened to me. And that's the story of me in the Marine Corps. I worked hard. I was the youngest NCO in the Marine Corps, and I wanted to be the youngest officer. And I worked hard, and I got an appointment to go to Quantico, Virginia, go to Officers Candidate School. And in 1965, I was down in Santo Domingo, Dominican Republic, and a little shooting thing going on down there. While I was down there, I had excellent night vision, so they would have me lead night patrols. One morning I woke up. I wasn't supposed to lead the patrol the night before, but I woke up one morning and I was fully clothed and I had my .45 in my holster and there were three rounds missing and it was around the chamber and the hammer was back and almost never slept like that. It turned out that they woke me up so I could go over and report on the patrol we led the night before where we took fire and returned fire and all that business. The problem was, the last thing I remember, I was laying in my tent working on my second bottle of rum. And so I led men into a combat situation, took and returned fire, and don't even remember being there. And I was terrified. And I knew that the Marine Corps is an abnormal way to live, and it made me drink funny. So I turned down that commission I'd worked so very hard for, and I got out. And that's the story of my alcoholism. I always fell in love with whatever I was doing, And then gradually or not so gradually, I'd violate every principle associated with that way of life. It was no wonder I failed. You can't not fail if you're violating principles. And I did the same thing in a marriage. I had no ability to be faithful. You know, my first daughter was born, beautiful Kelly. She was 4 months old in a crib. And I came home and her mother was a nurse who worked in an emergency room and had a bad accident on a beltway. And she had to run back into work. She had just gotten home and she had to run back into work. And she said, "Your dinner's in the oven and don't wake Kelly up. She's not feeling well. She's sick." And she ran on out. And I thought, isn't that wonderful? And then I realized that there was no booze in the house. And I began that alcoholic decision making. I paced back and forth and checked a neighbor. He wasn't home. So I made a decision. I made the only decision I now know I could have made. And that is that I got my money and I went in and I looked at Kelly, and this 4-month-old angel was asleep in the crib. And I watched her breathe for a little bit. And then I grabbed my car keys and I took off. And I ran to the liquor store and I bought a bottle and I ran home. My heart was pounding, and I was looking for a fire in the apartment, and on, and I went rushing in, and I stood there clutching my bottle to my heart, and she was breathing. And then I started, "You're no good. You call yourself a father. What kind of a father are you?" And I started at self-loathing, and I began to drink. Of course I began to drink. I had long since given up the choice about drinking. And then when I was about halfway through the bottle, the real problem presented itself. And that is, if her mother had been doing what she was supposed to be doing, and if she was any kind of a wife and mother, she would have been home with her baby the way she should have been. And so this woman, who worked 16 hours in a butcher shop of an emergency room, has to come home and listen to her husband carry on and scream and accuse her of being a bad wife and a bad mother. It was utter insanity. We were so crazy. We were so insane. You know, I struck her once in a blackout, and I wanted to die. I never thought I could ever do that. And I struck her in a blackout, and so I swore I wouldn't drink, and I didn't drink for a while, and then I began to drink again, and I came home one night, and I'd been out half the night, and I came home, she was seeing a psychiatrist by this time, which I thought explained why I drank. And he had told her to not be around me because I was beginning to become violent. And so she used to wear this thing, we called it the buffalo robe. Basically, it meant not tonight. And she had her buffalo robe on, and she's taking those pills, which made her eyes look in different directions at the same time, not unlike Dennis. And she had her matching buffalo robe house coat, and I did it anything a normal guy would do. I tore the apartment up and I was running around screaming like a lunatic and throwing furniture around, and she grabbed her matching buffalo robe house coat and her purse and took off. And I knew what she was going to do. She was going to go call the psychiatrist she was having an affair with, and then he was going to tell her to call the police because they wanted to get rid of me. And so I did what any normal drunk would do. I ran around, I cleaned the place up. It looked better than when I got home. I went in, I took my clothes off. I had these pajamas I wore when the police came. I put those on. The doorbell rang, and I messed my hair up. And I went, and I looked out, and there was my wife wrapped up in her buffalo robe and two policemen. There was a young guy about 20 and an old guy about 30. And I gathered myself as only an alcoholic can, and I opened the door and I said, "Thank God you found her." And the policeman said, "Sir, may we come in?" And I said, "Of course." I said, "I'm beside myself with worry." Now, when you're dealing with the police, you can't be too careful. So I said to her, "Honey, did you call the doctor?" And she said, "Yes." I said, "Well, good. If you're going to run out here in the middle of the night, at least you called the doctor." And she burst into tears and ran in the bedroom. And then, the older policeman reached over and hit me on the arm. He said, "Son, you hang in there." I said, "Yes, sir." And they left, and I went in. And I'll never forget this. I never want to forget this. She was sitting on the side of the bed crying those huge tears that only people were hurt so deeply that it tears the very fabric of their being, cry. And And she looked at me and said, "Can you forgive me for embarrassing you that way?" You know, and I said to her, I said, "Honey, you can't help it. You're just having a hard time." And I went and got her a glass of wine, and she got another one of those pills, and I got a glass of scotch. And, you know, we had a drink together, and then we went to bed and we made love because we knew we were the luckiest couple in the neighborhood. That's how crazy it had become. You know, our second child was born. She was almost 3 months premature. And I was drunk. Of course I was drunk because it was after 5 o'clock in the afternoon. And I somehow drove her to the hospital, and I just didn't want to have anything to do with it. There's something about alcoholism that so destroys or tears away the fabric of a human being's existence that there is no strength left anymore. A friend, old guy I used to know, said, "You know, you drink that stuff, it takes the sizing right out of your life." And that's precisely what had happened. There was nothing left inside of me to hold me up or hold me together anymore. Everything that I'd ever been had evaporated in alcohol. And, you know, this little girl was born who weighed less than 2 pounds, and they didn't expect her to live. And all I wanted to do was go home and go to bed. So that's what I did. And my wife called me and said, "Would you please come back to the hospital? They think she's going to die. I really need you here." And I was so angry, just so angry, so filled with rage, that I got in a car and I stormed across Washington, D.C. And I went up, and they had put her on an experimental machine. And the woman who was a chief resident in the neonatal nursery had gone to high school with me back in Ohio. And she said, "We want to put her on this machine. It's an experimental machine. I don't know if it's going to do any good." He said, "If she lives, we don't think she'll live, be honest with you. But if she does live, she'll be retarded because of the lack of oxygen. May we do it?" And I said, "You know, do whatever you want, Mary Kate. Do whatever you think you need to do." And I looked, and my wife was pacing back and forth and with a 1,000-yard stare and basically in a state of shock. And I knew what to do because I knew what my father would have done. My father's the greatest father, greatest husband who ever lived. And he'd have gone in and he'd put his arm around his wife and he'd have said, "Pat, with God we can do anything. You and me and God can do anything." I knew what to say. There was just nothing left inside of me to say it. And I cowered in an office across from the neonatal nursery basically for 3 days, and I didn't drink. And on the third day, which is the most critical time, my wife went in and baptized our little infant because they didn't think she'd live through the night. And I watched her. And then I ran downstairs to the chapel. Georgetown is a Catholic university. And I had been raised as a Catholic, and I loved the church when I was a kid. And every day I'd stop in and sit in front of the Eucharist and just sit there. And I ran downstairs, and I got in the chapel, and I got on my knees, and I begged the God I hadn't talked to in a long time to please save my little girl's life. I said, "If you'll save her, I'll do anything. If you save her, I won't drink." And I was drunk in 12 hours. And I never want to forget that I drank when I thought drinking would kill my baby. You know, one of my favorite philosophers is a man named Blaise Pascal. He's a philosopher. He's a Frenchman and philosopher and a mathematician. And he said, "God created man in his own image, and unfortunately, man returned the favor." And I had created a God who would kill a little girl because her dad was sick. And fortunately, that isn't how God does things. And that little girl lived. She's, some of you may not like this, but she's an honor graduate from Auburn University. I always tell her, "I think you can graduate from Auburn with honors and be retarded," but no, I'm just kidding. You can't long live like that. And I remember bits and pieces of 1972. I remember the 1st of November, 1972, my wife asked me if I would leave. And she said, "If you can't leave, I'll have to take the children and leave." She said, "I can't live like this." She said, "You're passing out and falling asleep with cigarettes." And she said, I can't think of anything but you and the kids when I'm away and when I'm at work. And you know, there was no fight left. I was greatly relieved I was hurt, of course, but I was greatly relieved, and I packed two suitcases and I left. And I went to where I needed to go. You know, later that month, I woke up, you know, one of those mornings when you don't recognize the ceiling and there's someone in bed next to you. And, you know, my first thought was, dear God, let it be a woman. And I never knew. And, you know, and in that embarrassing time, and it was very clear she didn't know me and I didn't know her. And I got dressed and I left, and I was walking up M Street in Georgetown, and I walked by a street clinic, and I just looked in the window, and a woman stuck her head out the door and said, "Son, why don't you come in and have a cup of coffee?" And I went in, and when I had a cup of coffee, and when I left, she said, "Happy Thanksgiving." And I went and I called my, first I went down to the corner of Wisconsin and M Street by the Rive Gauche, and there were two couples standing there talking, and I walked up and stood with them. And then he looked at me and said, "May we help you?" And I was shocked that they could see me. There was so little left of me that I thought I was invisible. And I went and called this woman who I'd tormented and abused and tortured, and said to her, "Can I come out for Thanksgiving dinner?" And she said, "If you don't drink, you can come at 6 o'clock. And I got out there at 6 o'clock and knocked on her door. And she opened the door and gave me a bag of turkey sandwiches and then closed the door. And I went and got a six-pack, and I went down by the reflecting pool near the Lincoln Memorial. And I sat on the steps and ate my turkey sandwiches and drank my beer. And, you know, somewhere between the second and third beer, I reasoned I was the luckiest man in the world, because I had somebody who loved me enough to give me turkey sandwiches on Thanksgiving. You know, the following May of 1973, May the 13th, 1973, I was in a basement of a house in the Skid Row section of Washington, D.C., and for all intents and purposes, my life was over. I went into what passed for a bathroom, and I just wanted to end it. You know, I would have thought that suicide was a big deal, but, you know, for an alcoholic, it's not a big deal. It's just the next deal. And I went in with every intention of never coming out of there. And I had all these pills. I had a whole medicine cabinet full of pills. You could, where I worked, you could take whatever you wanted. And I never used the stuff. You know, some of you think that's the saddest story you ever heard, but but you know, I never used it. I thought if God made anything better than scotch, he kept it for himself. And but I went into the bathroom to take it all. And to this day, I don't know if I began to take it or not. What I do know is I sort of screamed aloud, which now I understand is a prayer. Anytime the heart screams out, it's a prayer. And I said, "You're 29 years old, and at least it'll be over." And a woman spoke to me. And I mean, I don't mean some sort of psychotic thing. I mean, a woman spoke, and she spoke, and she was outside of me, and she spoke, and I heard her like, "You hear me." And she said, "It's not over, it's starting." It was like a bolt of lightning cut through the fog. And I realized what I was doing. I was doing the unpardonable. I was destroying the creation of God. And I ran out, and I remember my ex-wife had given me a phone number, and she said, "I can't help you. Maybe these people can." And I pulled the drawer out, and everything fell all over the floor, and I'm crawling around sobbing like an idiot. And I found this piece of paper with a phone number on it, and I called it, and it was a little treatment center. Now, some people don't like treatment centers in AA. I don't understand that, because we don't have opinions on things. But but I spoke to a woman who's a recovering alcoholic, and she knew how to talk to me, and I arranged to go there. And I was given a great gift that morning. I looked, and there was almost a full bottle of scotch on the draining board. And I knew that if I took one drink, I'd die. And I knew that knowing I'd die would never keep me from drinking. I didn't know Alcoholics Anonymous existed. That morning, God gave me the gift of the first step. I ran over and I started to pour that out, and I knew I wouldn't. I knew I was powerless over the stuff in that bottle. And I knew if I took one drink, I would die, and knowing I would die would never keep me from drinking. And I stepped back and I hurled the bottle as hard as I could into the sink, and it burst. If the bottle had bounced, you'd have a different speaker this morning. And you know, it's been almost 30 years. You know, if I take a drink, I'll die, and knowing I'll die will never keep me from drinking. My old friend Hal Marley, God rest his soul, always used to say to me when I was new, he said, "You know, Keith, it's not alcoholism, it's alcoholism." You know, when we start combining alcohol with every other thing that you can get hooked on, it worries me. You know, alcoholism, I when we start combining it with nicotine and all the rest of it, I quit smoking. Smoking's a bad habit. I never had a cigarette I didn't enjoy, but I quit smoking 27 years ago. I don't go to meetings to not smoke. Bad habits you get over. The disease of alcoholism, I know, is different than that. If I stop doing what I'm doing, I'll drink again. There's a drink out ahead of me. It's got my name on it. And when I was new, when I was brand new, it was 5 minutes ahead of me. I was so close to that thing that I could smell it from time to time. And I could actually taste it from time to time. But, you know, hanging around with you people, gradually I began to push that drink further and further and further out ahead of me. You know, there have been times in these last 29 years when I got a little bit nutsy. And I got a little bit too busy, and I changed higher powers, and I began to catch up to that drink. And I'll tell you something, if I ever catch up to the drink with my name on it, I'll drink it. Because you see, I'm powerless over alcohol. And by the grace of God, I've never caught up with it. And but that's what was given to me that morning. And then I waited 3 days, and I did the things that drunks used to do a lot. You know, I heard things, I saw things, I probably fell on the floor and flopped around some. Of course, I don't remember that part of it. But 3 days later, it was time to go to this place. It was 30 miles away. I got in the car, and it took me 6 hours to drive 30 miles. I had what we used to call the running fits. Now they call them anxiety attacks because you can get to take Valium. But back then, it was a running fits. And I'd start to shake, and I'd start to cry, and my heart would be jumping out of my chest. And I got out of the car, and I'd run up and down beside the road and Route 29 and just crying and screaming like a madman. And I wet my pants, and I'm changing my pants on Route 29, and the Phi Theta Kappa key fell out, and I wonder what had happened to this kid who had all this potential. And you know, that day, what I wanted was a place where they'd lock me up, where I'd never hurt myself or anybody again. And I finally got to this little place. It was a condemned hotel on the Potomac River, and they put me on a bus and took me to a place called Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never forget that day as long as I live, because that's the day that my life changed. That's the day someone reached inside of me and pulled away bits and pieces of my heart. There's a man who stood at the door who greeted people, much like the greeters here today. And he shook my hand and he looked me in the eye. And he said a very strange thing. He said, "Son, if you keep coming here, you never have to drink again." And I said, "You don't know me, mister. I'm a man who drinks when he thinks drinking will kill his little girl." Of course he knew me. Of course he knew me. And more importantly, he knew what I had. And even more important than that, he knew what you had. What you had was a solution for what I had. And I got to tell you, from that day till this day, I haven't had to take a drink of alcohol. You know, sometime in the month of December, I had to sit down and figure out when it is, because these things were important to me. Sometime in the month of December, I will have spent half of my life in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. You know, I don't know what happened to me. I was never a guy who joined anything. I was so isolated, so alone, that I never joined anything. I was the only guy I know is in the Marine Corps who never joined. One time, we stood at an inspector general inspection, and I was in charge of all the guns, and we just had the highest marks you could have. And this lieutenant came to me. He's now a general. I've helped a lot of people up the ladder. he came to me and he said, "Louis," he said, I can't thank you enough." He said, you're the best NCO I have." And I said, "Well, lieutenant," I said, "I just like working for you." He said, "Don't kid yourself or me." He said, "You do twice as much as you have to just so you don't have to work for anybody." And that's the way I live my life. I never meant to join you. Just never meant to. It's just that when you live in that isolation, that horrible, horrible, dark, deep hole, and you see a light, and you see a hand, and you know you're sinking fast, you just grab. And that's what I did. I just grabbed. And I began being with you. I remember saying to a man in that treatment center one time, my roommate, I said, "I love those people. I'll do anything they ask me to do." I said, "If they tell me to go sit in a tree, I'm going to go sit in a tree." And he said, "My God, they brainwashed you." Yeah. You know, 1 year later, I celebrated 1 year of sobriety in Alcoholics Anonymous. And that kid, he was the only one in there younger than me. I was 29, he was 27. And he had a Corvette outside, and I had an Opel station wagon that belched blue smoke. He owned a huge farm down on the eastern shore of Maryland. And most of all, he was tall. Yeah. And the women loved him, just loved him. And of course I hated him. And, you know, 1 year later, my sponsor is speaking at my first birthday or anniversary, they called it, in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I looked back there, and there was that man. He was on the back row, and he had a patch on his eye, and he'd had a bad year. That year, I studied in France. I spent time in a monastery in Rome. I was insane, but I was just filled with more joy and more excitement. And I looked back here, and there's a man sitting back there, and my sponsor said, "Keith did everything wrong this year except two things." He said he didn't drink, and he went to 500 AA meetings. He said he went to meetings where he didn't even speak the language. He said, "But that makes sense because he drank in bars where he didn't speak the language," which was true. And when it was over, this man who was feared for my brainwashing came up to me and he shook my hand. He said, "I know you really like this stuff." He said, "Congratulations." He said, "But don't you think you're overdoing it with the meetings?" And I knew what kind of year this man had had. He had lost that farm. He'd wrapped that Corvette around a telephone pole. And he'd been in St. Elizabeth's Hospital, which is a state hospital in Washington, D.C., and someone had gouged his eye out with an ice pick. And I didn't know what to say to him, and I didn't want to be cruel, but I desperately wanted him to experience what I had experienced. And I said to him, "You know, I don't know how to say this, but one of us got one eye and one of us got two eyes." And I wasn't being cruel, I swear I wasn't. I just didn't know how you convey the magnificence of surrender to someone who's fearful of things like brainwashing and joining and being a part of. You know, my life took off. I mean, it took off in ways that I just can't imagine. You know, and I worked those steps, and I worked them clumsily. And I had all the experiences they talk about in the big book. Every one except the one where we step across the street and have a couple drinks. I didn't have that one. But I had every other experience in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous. It was magnificent. You know, that day came when no human power will keep us from taking a drink. And I was sober about 4 months, and that day came. And I was so overwhelmed with guilt about these two beautiful little girls that I had essentially lost. And to a great extent, I've lost to this day, I'm afraid to say. And though I want to be in their lives, and I try to be, and I'm consistent. But I love them so very, very much, and their children. But I was overwhelmed with guilt, and I went to the meeting, not because I wanted to go to the meetings, because I always went to the meeting. And the meeting was led by a man named Harold, and I understand it that Harold is gone now. But Happy Harold was a man who everybody loved in Washington, D.C., and he led our meeting, and he's a beautiful man. He's a black man. He had those eyes that could look through you for three generations. I went for coffee after the meeting, not because I wanted to go for coffee, but because that's what I always did. And we were at the Potter's House on Columbia Road in Washington, D.C., everybody was having ice cream and cake, and everybody was talking, and I couldn't hear anything anybody said because I was so overwhelmed with the knowledge that I wasn't worth sobriety. And I got up to leave, and I don't know what would have happened. It couldn't have been good because I had no options available to me at that moment. And I walked by the table, and Harold said, "Son, I don't think I know you." He said, "You got a few minutes?" And I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, my name's Happy Harold, and I'm an alcoholic." I said, "Yes, sir, I know. You led the meeting." And he sat down, and he looked at me, and he said, "You look troubled." And I said, "Well," I said, I said, "I'm just so guilty about my children." And he didn't say you shouldn't feel that way. He said, "I know how you feel." And then he told me this story about his mother called him from intensive care and said, "Harold, I want you to come and see me. But be sober. I don't want to go into eternity seeing my oldest boy drunk." And he said, "The next morning I went to the hospital and I was drunk." I said, "You were?" He said, "Of course I was drunk." He said, "I'm an alcoholic and I hadn't yet met Alcoholics Anonymous. Of course I was drunk. I had to be drunk." And I began to understand that what was going on frequently wasn't my choice. And He said, my brothers and sisters came, and they said, Harold, you can't go up and see Mama like that. And so he said, he called up to intensive care and said, Mama, can I come and see you? And she said, not if you're drinking, son. And he said, so my brothers and sisters said goodbye to Mama. I sat down in the waiting room, and she died, and I never got to say goodbye to her. I said, how do you live with that? And he smiled, only the way Harold could smile. And he said, son, if you stay with us, you're going to know that the worst things you do becomes your greatest gift. And I was so overwhelmed with Harold's story, I forgot to go home and die. And it must have been a few months later, I was in the hospital, and Harold was at the elevator, and I went over, and we hugged and shook hands and talked for a minute. Then he left, and a nurse came to me and said, do you know Mr. Butler? I said, you mean Happy Harold? She said, he's the finest man I know. And I said, really? She said, yeah. She said, you know, she said, whenever we have an old person here who's dying and has nobody, we call Harold, and he comes and helps them die. And those words rang through my mind. The worst you do becomes your greatest gift. And I understood that they aren't wasted years. They really aren't wasted years. That what we lived becomes the gold in the life of other human beings. Everything that I've been given today, I'm given through Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything. I was given everything from my parents, from the church I grew up in, the town I grew up in, the country I grew up in, the Marine Corps, everything I've been given. But none of it was of value until I met you. You translated everything that's good in my life. You're sort of the Rosetta Stone of my existence, because nothing made sense to me until you interpreted it for me. And I'm so profoundly grateful for that. People say to me sometimes, they said, do you ever get tired of traveling and speaking? And of course I do. I mean, there's no place I'd rather be than right now walking around the 3-mile loop that my wife and I walk holding hands. There's no place I'd rather be. But I owe you so much. And I'm further in debt to you every day. I can't even pay the interest on the principal. You know, worked those steps, and I wanted to talk a little bit about that dad who never told me he loved me. You know, I went home a couple times to make amends to him. I'd drive from Washington, D.C. to Ohio to make amends, and I'd be with him about 10 minutes, and I'd get so angry, I'd get up, get my car, and drive back to Washington. I didn't understand it. I just didn't understand it, and Sandy B. was my sponsor then, and Sandy kept saying, Keith, I think you're getting close. I said, it's not working. He said, no, I think you're getting close. He said, I think you need to pray just a little bit more. You know, my father said to my mother, said, you know, I really like that boy, but he drives a long way for a cup of coffee. And he never understood me. And I didn't know what to do about it. And, you know, one day I was reading a big, big book, and I ran across that little suggestion about honoring your parents, you know. And I realized that I had never honored them. I was embarrassed by poverty. I was embarrassed by the fact that my mom's dresses were torn. I was embarrassed by the fact that Dad owned one suit. When he came and watched me graduate from Paris Island Boot Camp with Dress Blues Award and all the rest of it, I have that picture which is so dear to my heart today. But there's a man in August in South Carolina in a wool suit, because what he owned was a wool suit. And I didn't ever honor them. You don't honor people who owe you. And I decided that day, with God's help, I was going to honor him. And that's what I did. I never had an opinion opposite of his again. Al-Anon taught me a lot. One of the things they taught me was to say things like, you know, I never really looked at it that way before, Dad. And those are the things I started saying. And I stopped competing with my father. I just honored him. And honor went to treasure. I began to treasure him. And I thought back to the times that the comfort that he had offered me that I didn't know was love. When I was a little kid, he'd come home from work, and he was a machinist in a factory, and he smelled like oil. And he used to pick the steel chips out of his fingers he'd sterilize a needle and start picking steel chips. And then he'd pour hydrogen peroxide on his hands, and all the kids would stand around and watch Dad's hand foam. And and then when he'd come in from work, he'd hug me. And he smelled like oil and sweat. And, you know, this month, 1962, I was in 1st Battalion, 8th Marines, and we were on standby when the Cuban Missile Crisis happened. And so we were the first there. And I was this 18-year-old kid in a, looking across the fence line at about 80,000 crack Cuban troops and Russian troops, you know, knowing that there are 3,000 of us and it's not looking good. And I was afraid, and I was up that night. It was my turn to stand watch. I was up that night, and a mosquito had landed on my face, and I had been cleaning my .45, and I went to brush the mosquito away with the oily rag, and it smelled like my father. I was overwhelmed with this sense of safety and of love. And I didn't know how to translate that at that time. I thought, what a strange thing. I didn't know how to translate it because I had not yet met the Rosetta Stone. I was just a frightened, angry, self-centered, demanding victim. And you know, I began to honor my father, and I had bought a house down in at the beach in North Carolina. My father and mother had never seen a beach. You don't go to the beach a lot when you have 11 children. And so they came. I brought them down to the ocean, and my dad was just overwhelmed with the ocean. And he'd sit and watch the waves pound, and he said to me, "Does it keep doing that?" I said, "As long as I've been watching, Dad." And so I moved to Birmingham, Alabama, and I asked him if they would keep an eye on my house for me. And he said, "Well, we'll be glad to." They kept an eye on it for 6 years. And Dumb Denny bought him a car. It was the first car my father had since my mother got pregnant with their first child in 1939. And Dad sat in the beach house and drove his car around Carolina Beach. And I was traveling a lot, and I'd always go by and see Dad. And one day, we're sitting in a beach house rocking in a rocking chair, and I was just honoring him. And he said, "Son, remember the first day that you went to work?" And I said, "Yeah." I said, "I worked in a bowling alley." He said, "Yeah." He said, "You were 12 years old." And he said, "Remember I took you to lunch?" I said, "No, I don't remember that." He said, "Yeah." He said, "We went to Louis' hot dog stand." He said, "Do you remember what you had?" And I said, "I'm going to go out on a limb here, Dad. Did I have a hot dog?" And he said, "Of course you did, you damn loon." He always called me a loon. He said, "Do you remember what you drank?" And I said, "Well, I probably drank orange pop because I always drank orange pop." He said, "Not that day." He said, "That day you drank root beer because I drank root beer. And I think you thought men who work drank root beer." And he said, "I explained to you how to do a good day's work for a good day's pay." My father was teaching his scrawny little son how to grow up when he was 12 years old. And he said, "I walked you to the bus stop and I said, 'Do you want me to come down with you on the first day?' And you said, 'No thanks, Dad, I'll do it myself.' And he said, 'I watched the bus till it was out of sight, and you never looked back.' And he said, 'You know, from that day on,' he said, 'you never let me do anything for you.' He said, 'You never let me help you.' He said, 'You didn't let me help you go to college.' He said, 'You did everything yourself.'" And I thought I was supposed to. I thought that's what the oldest son in an Irish family did. And I realized why I owed my father an amends. It wasn't because I worried him, although I did. I was insane and crazy. And they knew if there was any place shooting in the world, I was volunteering to go there. It was just out of my mind. That isn't why I owed him an amends. I owed him an amends because I never allowed him to do what he did best. And that was to be my father. And you know, a week later, I borrowed $1,000 from him. You know? I put it in the bank for about a month, and I gave it back to him. And from that day till the day he died, we were like that. We were best friends. And I just let him be my dad. And I honored him. And that whole world, that incredible love that he always had for us all, just opened up to me. And it was sometimes overwhelming. You know, I was with him when he lost his wife, the woman he was married to for 54 years, and so precious to him. You know, and I was with Mom, and we were talking about, you know, Don's talk about the tremendous gifts that Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon had given to her family. I had to think of when Mom was she suffered beautifully. She called it her final prayer. She suffered 6 months with cancer. And she said it was her final prayer. And she offered her final prayer so that all her children would come closer to God. And all have. And I would get down there at night and I'd pray the rosary. She left the rosary and I'd pray it aloud. And she'd wake up and pray with me for a while and then go back to sleep. And I was there one night with my brother Denny, who's also a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, or Larry, I mean, and he was a member of AA. Denny never made it, but And my niece came in and wanted me to come to the meeting with her. She's a member too, and she said, "Come to the meeting." She said, "My sponsor's speaking." And I said, "Well, I thought I'd spend the evening with Mom." And my mother, who I thought was asleep, said, "Boys, look at me." She always said that when she really meant it. And she said, "Boys, look at me." And she pointed at Larry and I. She said, "You must promise me you'll always go to Alcoholics Anonymous. Those were the people who brought my boys home to me." And, you know, I thought back when I made amends to her. I was sober 4 years. And I said, "What can I do? Anything." And she noticed my four-year token. And she said, "I'd really admire to have one of those coins one day." So every year, I sent a token to her and my dad on May the 13th. And my mom listed the things she wanted in her coffin. You know, she had 11 children, 20 grandchildren, 30 great-grandchildren. You know, the pictures were all over the wall, and she listed the things that she wanted in her coffin. And at the very top of the list was her son Keith's 23-year chip. "I owe it all to you, all of it." And I watched this strong man hold his wife's hand. And, you know, Dad developed cancer. And last October, I went to see him, and we had that talk that I hope everyone has with their mom and dad. I sat next to him. He was in a chair, and I sat next to him. And I said, "Dad, is there anything we need to say to each other?" And he said, "No, son." He said, "We've said it all." He said, "I know you love me, and you know I love you." And that really is saying it all. And I got up to leave, and he said, "There is one thing." And I said, "What's that, Dad?" He said, "Thank you." He said, "Thanks for all you've done for so many people, especially the people in our family. You know, I never wired it together, but my family is absolutely riddled with members of Al-Anon and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I was the first, but I never thought about that." And, you know, that man died last December. And I was standing by his bed. My lovely wife, Julia, and some of my brothers and sisters and nieces and nephews were there. And we all prayed with him. And, you know, I held his hand, and I told him it was okay to go home to see Mom. And my brother Terry had passed away just before my mom. And I said, "You can go see Mom and Terry now." And I promised him that I'd pray for everybody that he prayed for, because he prayed every day. And we prayed the Lord's Prayer. And when we said amen, my father squeezed my hand and went into eternity. I left that room and I said to my wife, "I'm not supposed to live like this. I'm supposed to be down the street, and I'm supposed to be trying to drink up enough courage to come here. I'm not supposed to live like this. But of course I am. Of course I'm supposed to live like this." You know, when I was sober, just a short period of time, about 7 years, I guess, I moved to North Carolina. And my wife, or my ex, I was out on a porch at the deck overlooking this little lake. And I was praying to God as I understand him. And I was reading a big book and a big, big book. And again, I was overwhelmed with this whole concept of God's love for me. And I just said, "Why me, Father? You know, why have you picked me? Millions of people die of alcoholism every year. Why have you picked me?" And I thought back to when I was in that little treatment center and I called this woman I had tormented and tortured so, my ex-wife, and I said, "I'm an alcoholic." She said, "No kidding." I said, "Why me?" She said, "Why not you? If anybody deserves it, you do." And she hung up. And I'm speaking to my father. And I said, "Why me?" And what I heard in my heart was, "Why not you, son? If anybody deserves it, you do." And I've come to realize that what I've been given by you is precisely what the God of my understanding always wanted for me. You know, I'm not better, I'm not worse, I'm not up, I'm not down, I'm one of you. And all I ever wanted to be was a guy who belonged someplace. And now I belong wherever I am. The spot I stand in, that moment is mine, and that's hard for me to understand. I must tell you this, and then I'll sit down and shut up. The woman who spoke to me, you know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, and I was religiously anti-religious. You've probably seen a few of them. I sat around waiting to be offended. I was not long ago, I spoke at a conference in a country north of here, remain anonymous, and they I noticed they didn't end in the Lord with the Lord's Prayer. And so I just said, "How long have you done that?" And they said, "Well, we've always ended meetings with the Serenity Prayer." Well, this one woman, sober 20 years, said, "That's a Christian prayer." And I said, "No, it's not." She said, "It most certainly is." I said, no. I said, "When that prayer was written, there weren't any Christians." And then finally we got down to the truth. She said, "It's a gender-specific prayer." I said, "Well, yeah, I'll give you that. It is a gender-specific prayer." So, and I'm thinking, that was me 25 years ago, you know. And boy, that's a hard way to go. I loathed the church I grew up in. And the reason I did was because I couldn't do what they were asking me to do. And I thought everybody else was. I didn't understand it. Spiritual people do the best they can with what they have. And they have a God who forgives them when they fall short. And I didn't know that. I thought you had to be perfect. And it's easier to give up. And a sponsor of mine recommended it. I go back before I write all them off. That is part of my inventory work. I should go back and find out a good reason to leave. And I went back and I began to study about the church. Now, I had gone on and gotten a degree in theology and everything, but I was doing that to defend myself in case I ever bumped into God. But I went back and I remembered something about Fatima, an apparition in Fatima. And when I was a little kid, I was knighted as a Knight of Fatima. It was a cute little thing. And the bishop, our bishop, was there, and I was about 8 years old, and he said, "Now you have a very special relationship with the Mother of God. And, when you most need her, she'll be there for you." And I thought that was nice, I grew up and got wise and scientific and got a degree in philosophy, and if you have a degree in philosophy, you don't need God. And because you figure it out on your own. And then I fell into that horrible spiritual illness of skepticism and cynicism, a skeptic and a cynic is someone who's afraid. And that's what I was. I was a frightened man who desperately wanted God. I decided I'd go back and look at this. And so I bought a book on Fatima written by a guy named Walsh. And I opened it on the first page. It talked about this apparition that supposedly occurred on May the 13th, 1917. And it hit me like a ton of bricks. The day that woman spoke to me was May the 13th, 1973. And if there was ever a day that I needed God more than that day, I don't know when it was. Thank you.